Right, here we are. Didactic Mind, Episode 7, The Destruction of Star Wars. A very warm welcome to all of my listeners, particularly my longtime readers from the blog. A very warm welcome to my subscribers from SoundCloud. And if you have just tuned in, if this is new to you, then please hit the subscribe button so that you are always notified of a new upload. You never miss a new episode of this podcast. As those who are regular listeners will know, the last couple of episodes were delayed by a couple of weeks because I was traveling. But there will be some catch-up episodes, so, you know, there's one coming up for Christmas, and there'll be another one for New Year's Eve, just to keep things lively and interesting. And more likely New Year's Day rather than New Year's Eve, because New Year's Eve everybody's going to be busy partying, of course. So, but given the way things are moving, given current events, and given the nature of pop culture right now, I thought it might be wise to take a break from some of the philosophizing from the last couple of episodes and look at something a little bit more present day, if you will. Those who have been reading my work for a long time know quite well that I am a huge Star Wars fan, or rather, I used to be a huge Star Wars fan. With the release of Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, worldwide, I believe, on Friday night, I thought it might be worth taking a canter through the Star Wars canon and understanding exactly why it is that this new film and the previous two that came before it are such a massive insult to all of us who believe in the good, the beautiful, and the true. Now, most of you who are listening to this and who are Star Wars fans, or even just like casual viewers of the series, will know that fan reaction to the last two films, The Last Jedi in 2017 and The Force Awakens in 2015, was muted at best. I mean, The Force Awakens got a lot of good publicity from a lot of people, and the fan base was really energized and pumped. But upon reflection, they realized, yeah, you know what, it's not really that good. Then The Last Jedi came along and just absolutely spat upon the entirety of the Star Wars fan base, all of the hardcore fans. I mean, it was so widely reviled and hated by them, it's not even funny. Excuse me a moment. For those of you who are new to the pleasures of good single malt scotch, I highly recommend sitting back on a Sunday evening and sipping some Macallan 12 or something similar, of a similar vintage. I've tried many, many different Scotch whiskies, but Macallan, Glenfiddich, and Laphroaig, and Lagavulin remain my absolute favorites. And the funny thing is, the first whiskey is smooth and mellow and wonderful, and the other two are extraordinarily smoky. I mean, still very smooth, but oh my lord, they are smoky. Back on topic. The Last Jedi truly pissed off so many fans, it's not even funny. The fan base was absolutely outraged by what was done to their beloved series, their saga and their canon. And looking back upon it with the benefit of about 23 years of hindsight from the time that I truly remember watching the first film, it's astonishing how far down the saga has gone. Now, the reason I was motivated to talk about this tonight is because of a rather interesting rant, basically, by Bill Whittle. He's a boomer. I mean, he's a baby boomer. He's tail end of the baby boomers, in fact. He's about 60 years old. And he was, I think, he said he was 17 or 18 years old when he first saw, Star Wars at a drive-in theater in 1977. And he was hooked instantly. And he recorded an episode of Bill Whittle Now with Scott Ott, in which he analyzed and broke down exactly why it is that Star Wars 9, The Rise of Skywalker, is such an utter disaster of a movie. And not just a disaster in terms of the important stuff, plot, character, realism, or at least something resembling a realistic story arc, character development, not having too many MacGuffins, you know, interactions between characters, the battle between good and evil, all of this stuff. Not only is it a colossal disaster on all of these fronts, but it completely subverts and destroys the entire point of the Star Wars story. To understand why, you have to go back to the very beginning of these films, and I'll link to Bill's episode in the description box so you can see it for yourself. It's also going to be in my post, my great Monday dacked browser crash tomorrow morning, so you can view it and load it up and see exactly what he's on about, because he does have a lot of very interesting things to say. Now, back when Star Wars came out in 1977, it filled a gap in the popular culture in a way that has never been done before, had never been done before, and still hasn't been done. It came out at basically the perfect time, when America was deep in the midst of an identity crisis. America had just come out of the Vietnam War a few years earlier. 58,000 dead, tens of thousands of more wounded. The very core of American identity destroyed, the very idea of America shaken to its foundations. A president who resigned rather than be impeached. A very shaky sense of self-belief. In fact, a strong belief that America was on decline, in terminal decline. Inflation was rampant. Unemployment was high. The future looked really bleak. America looked like it was doomed. And the Soviet Union, the evil empire, looked like it was going to take over and conquer the world. It was into this strange mess that America found itself in that George Lucas and his space opera stepped in and gave the film viewing public something they did not expect. Because what you saw in America at the time were hard, gritty, realistic movies that depicted daily life, that, you know, the savagery of the inner cities. Films like Dirty Harry, Death Wish, and some of the other, you know, really gritty crime dramas that came out in that period in the 1970s. Because everything about America, everything that made America what it was falling apart. Its sense of self was destroyed. It no longer had any sense that it was a virtuous and good country the way it did in the 1950s after World War II, when it came out of that war the only major power that was not severely damaged. In so doing, America had lost its moral moorings. It had lost track of what made America wonderful and good. And that breakdown in national character was reflected in the American heartland. In every way, the new upcoming boomer generation had reason to be afraid, unhappy, dissatisfied. They were really chafing at the moral strictures of the previous generations, of the greatest generation, the silent. They were trying very hard to find their own identity. And they couldn't, you know, for a long time. And their identity was formed out of rebelling against their superiors. Their identity was formed from rejecting traditional wisdom and rejecting what were once considered sensible and sane roles and traditional morals. Now, this resulted in the most narcissistic, damaging generation of all time. You and I, you know, if you're anywhere under the age of 40, are the direct products of the world that the boomers created. Even if you're under 50, actually, because the generation that came along right after them was Gen X. And the Gen Xers, you know, the tail end of the very first of them are around the age of 53, 54, and 55, thereabouts. They came of age in a world that really had completely abandoned anything that would make sense to previous generations. They were called the latchkey generation for a reason. And they came of age in a time of deep cynicism and deep unhappiness about their existence and their way of life. And into that void, into that generational chasm of the conflicting viewpoints of the highly idealistic, some would argue very stupid, boomers, and the very cynical, very world-weary, angry, unhappy Gen Xers, stepped Star Wars. Star Wars was something, at least to American audiences, that was almost completely new. American audiences were used to spaghetti westerns, where tales of morality were packaged in sometimes gritty, sometimes difficult, fairly simplistic versions of good versus evil, set in the Old West. You know, you would see basically the stories of the American heartland repackaged and told in ways that made it clear that America was forged out of this vast wilderness, that there was this this attempt to impose order upon chaos. And that was kind of the standard for such moral tales. It was a good standard, but it wasn't working anymore. It wasn't resonating anymore with the boomer crowd, who rejected many of the Westerns in favor of much more morally ambiguous tales. I mean, if you look at Dirty Harry, for instance, Dirty Harry is a great movie, but it's actually kind of a morally ambiguous one. I mean, Harry Callahan goes well over the line of what we would consider civilized and proper behavior for a law enforcement officer. It's a great movie, and I love it. And but it was called a right-wing fantasy by the progressive left at the time, who were very much in the process of locking down their control over the media and the institutions at the time. So they needed to be a new medium to tell this story, and that medium was space opera. And when it came to space opera, the Americans did it better than anybody else. No, I actually take that back. I would say they did it almost as good as the British did. The Brits, I think, still set the standard for that kind of campy, silly, and yet fun way of telling stories set in science fiction. And that's because they had a big head start. I mean, the golden age of American science fiction in the 1950s was comprised of men like Robert A. Heinlein, Arthur C. Clarke, that was British, Isaac Asimov, and several others who wrote and created these, you know, marvelous worlds of fiction. But when it came to transferring it onto film, the Brits were still some of the best around, with one exception, which is Flash Gordon. That show was, you know, the American attempt to create a sci-fi series that would work and be relatable to an audience, but it was still kind of cheesy, kind of silly, and kind of grandiose. But it resonated with American audiences. It worked. It was a very popular show back in the day, and with good reason. So George Lucas came along with all these influences, all these ideas rattling around in his head, he took the best bits of the films that he loved and created something that was just, in his mind at least, a complete pastiche of everything that he had grown up enjoying. If you've ever seen an Akira Kurosawa film called The Hidden Fortress, in many parts of Star Wars are the original Star Wars Episode 4, as it's called now, but back when it was released in 77, it was just called Star Wars. It was never intended to be a multi-part series. That only came much later, after the massive, you know, unexpected success, the cultural phenomenon that became Star Wars. But if you look at that film, Akira Kurosawa's The Hidden Fortress, you will see all of the standard tropes in Star Wars in that movie. And that was, you know, it's a black and white film concerning a samurai, an aging samurai who goes forth to rescue a princess who's been captured and held in a secret fortress, and he infiltrates that fortress and finds a way to get her out, I think with the help of a young assistant who he meets and initially doesn't really like. And, you know, I mean, I last time, when I saw this film, it must have been 20 years ago. So, you know, it's been that long since I watched The Hidden Fortress. But it was immediately obvious exactly where the influences were. So he took that. He took Flash Gordon. He took aspects of Dune, actually. He took aspects, I'm serious, of Frank Herbert's Dune, which came out like 10 years before, and created Tatooine out of that. He took aspects of other sci-fi canons and created something wonderful, something amazing, something incredible. And the thing is, if you actually watch it now, you know, with adult eyes, I mean, the first time I watched it, I was in my preteens. Seriously, I was that young. If you actually watch it today, it's cheesy and it's campy and everybody's hair looks ridiculous and the fashions are horribly out of date, and, you know, it's obviously a movie informed by the 1970s, you know, the fashions and the styles and the accents and everything. They're very clearly from the 70s. There was no getting away from that. I mean, there was no way to completely divorce yourself from the daily realities of life, given the tiny budget that George Lucas had at the time. I mean, and it was tiny. He made the entire film on a complete shoestring. But the level of innovation and adaptation that was required to do this was unbelievable. George Lucas came up with ways to capture dogfights in space, which he basically adapted almost shot for shot from aerial footage captured of dogfighting in World War II between American fighters and Japanese fighters, or American fighters and British fighters against German fighter planes. And he adapted it almost perfectly into space, into the realm of space, to the point where you could completely suspend your disbelief about the fact that it was operating in a non-Newtonian world, so to speak. If you watch the flight dynamics in Star Wars, it's very obvious that it's not happening in a vacuum. It's happening in atmosphere. The way the aircraft are behaving, despite their outlandish shapes, I mean, a TIE fighter could not fly in atmosphere, but an X-Wing could, in theory at least. You can see, it's blatantly obvious that the way the dogfights happen, the way the aircraft are designed to move in that film, is totally informed by World War II dogfighting. So he wove all of these things together into a coherent plot and a coherent story, an interesting story. And it was a story about a young man who has big ambitions, big dreams, but no way to express them. And he suddenly found and picked for a quest. And he goes through the classic hero's journey. He starts the process in Star Wars, going from a raw, untested, unspanked cub to a man, you know, just a boy, into a man who grows under pressure and who becomes a man in the sternest of tests. He is tested, and he is tested to, and maybe even beyond, his breaking point. He loses people along the way that he cares about. he is forced into strange alliances with people that he doesn't really know. He becomes a man worthy of the name. He becomes a man in the process. And it is a wonderful thing to see. It is a coming-of-age story. And above this coming-of-age story is this magnificent plot arc of good versus evil, presented in very stark terms. The evil is absolutely obvious. It is presented to you in the form of a 7'6" asthmatic robot with a skull for a face. And he is so terrifying, so intimidating. Little children and dogs, puppies, would wet themselves every time Darth Vader walked on the screen. I still remember my first visit to Disneyland, or to Disney World, I forget, whichever one's in Florida. Okay, so, you know, I've forgotten exactly which, but there was an actor in a Darth Vader costume, you know, striding around, because this was like at the height of Star Wars mania, several years after Return of the Jedi came out. And it was really cool. I mean, I loved being there. But then the moment I saw Darth Vader, I screamed and I ran for my mom, because he was bloody terrifying. And remember, I was tiny at the time. I couldn't have been more than 4 years old. So he was terrifying. And he was this incredibly intimidating, terrifying, scary, brutal character who killed without hesitation, and who was the absolute chief enforcer of the evil empire. In every way, the film was a brilliant construction. It was a classic tale of good versus evil, told in ways that anybody could understand, whether you were 5 years old or 55 years old or 105 years old, you could still understand it. It was that good. It had its problems, it had its flaws, of course. It is very far from perfect. If you watch it today, you're going to realize that it is actually quite ridiculous in a lot of ways. It's a really, really, really silly movie in many, many ways. But its flaws actually make it more endearing. The flaws of the people in the film make it more endearing. Han Solo is a lovable rogue, but he's very selfish. He's not interested in helping other people. Princess Leia is kind of a snotty brat, if you think about it. I mean, she's a strong, independent woman, but she's also a bit of a pain in the ass. I'm a strong, independent woman's hear me roar sort of way that sort of bullshit that you get these days. But she's actually kind of likable, despite being annoying. Luke is callow, untested, a bit whiny, a bit annoying. You know, you want to smack him sometimes. But he's a really likable, relatable young man. He's got, in his fresh face, he's full of promise. He understands that he's got a lot of challenges ahead of him. And he wants to face them. He's eager. He has the eagerness of youth. And so on and so forth. I mean, you go all the way through the film. Every single memorable character is interesting and fun. So that's the background of the films. That is the genesis of this series. And then you get to Empire Strikes Back, which is the best of, you know, undisputably the best in cinematic terms of the entire saga, where the rebellion really faces its a true crisis. It really takes a kicking. It gets beaten down. Han and Luke and Leia all suffer terrible losses. Luke himself goes from being a somewhat cocksure but untested youth, a young man who still needs to learn a lot, to having those lessons introduced to him in the most brutal and painful way possible. And then you get to Return of the Jedi, where that untested young man is gone, and he's replaced with a confident, mature, seasoned, wise, deeply compassionate young man, a true man, who still has to face his greatest ever test, but now appears to be ready for it, and is ready to perform the redemption, to complete the redemption of Darth Vader, who we don't see it, we didn't see it in the original trilogy, but he was always meant to play a much bigger role as George Lucas created and fleshed out his story in his head. And then, you know, 20 years, fast forward, 24 odd years, or 14 odd, yeah, something like that, 20 odd years, and you get to the Star Wars prequels, which were, no two ways about it, a bloody disaster. They were terrible. But they did at least succeed in fleshing out the story of Darth Vader and explaining why it was that Vader's fall was so catastrophic, why he needed to be redeemed, and why the power of good was still in him. The fact that it was so bad, the fact that the prequels were so badly acted, is essentially due to terrible casting choices and to the fact that George Lucas himself is not a good director. Let's face facts. George Lucas was always more about the technology and the special effects and the wow factor than he was about directing anybody human. He was always a terrible director of people. He was and remains a phenomenal visual effects artist. And that's what makes Star Wars special, because the visual effects were like nothing anybody had ever seen up until that point. And in many ways, they still are. I mean, you can throw all the CGI you want at a screen, but there's nothing quite like watching Industrial Light and Magic's original work, or the way that Skywalker Sound and THX digital audio came along, or not digital audio, but THX audio solutions came along. George Lucas had to invent all this stuff on the fly. He had to create it all himself, because nobody at the time had the technology and the ability to do what he wanted to do. So, having explained how brilliant the previous films were, let's look at why the current films are so terrible. The last three movies. There is no story arc. There is no sense of personal growth. The characters are all despicable. They're disgusting. They're stupid. You can't stand any of them. Rey is a colossal Mary Sue, and I've had arguments with my own family about this. Time has shown that I won those arguments, because there is no question that as a character, Rey has no flaws. She's absolutely perfect. She never experiences very much of any kind of serious growth or development. She is just perfect. She can use a lightsaber from the beginning. She can do. She's a highly skilled martial artist. She can shoot with a blaster perfectly the second time she picks it up. She can fly the Millennium Falcon perfectly after just a few minutes of tinkering around. She can fix anything she wants. She can infiltrate any base that she wants. She is just a. She can speak multiple alien languages despite never having been off her home planet. She can beat the crap out of two guys armed with weapons who are each three times her size. Now, I happen to have a perspective on this that most don't. I have trained in martial arts. I trained actively in martial arts for 5 years. And for the past year and a half, I have been basically stuck with just hitting a heavy bag once or twice a week. As, you know, just to keep my striking skills sharp. But I have trained against women. I've sparred against women. There is no way that somebody like Rey could fight against somebody like me. Not going to happen. I am much bigger and much stronger and much faster than somebody like Rey is. And if you actually watch Rey's lightsaber fighting sequences in either the trailers or the movies themselves, you will quickly realize that whoever is doing the fight coordination, the fight choreography for these movies, has no clue, has no understanding whatsoever of the realities of swordplay against a bigger, stronger, faster, tougher opponent. Rey's swings are slow. They are wild. They are uncontrolled. There is no sense of style or precision to them. It's not like when you're watching, particularly, for instance, Episode 3, Revenge of the Sith. If you watch carefully, you'll realize that Whoever did the fight choreography for that understood the need to introduce different lightsaber fighting styles into the movie. So if you watch closely, you'll see that Mace Windu has a very distinct fighting style. Emperor Palpatine has a distinct fighting style. Kit Fisto has a distinct fighting style. Obi-Wan Kenobi has a very obvious fighting style. It's called Sorisu. Form 3. And the reason why they introduced the different lightsaber fighting forms was to show off these different ways of using a lightsaber. Whereas with Rey, there is no such development, no such evolution of fighting styles. You just see her swinging a lightsaber like it's a two-handed bat, and she's using very wild swings, and she's leaving herself massively open. In reality, if somebody like that was fighting against a trained swordsman, she'd be cut down instantly. There's no question that in the films, you know, just looking at it from a dispassionate observer's perspective, she's hopeless. There's no way that you can argue that Rey is a skilled lightsaber combatant. Certainly not by the standards of the original films, certainly not by the standards of the prequels. But, you know, because Rey is perfect and wonderful, she beats everybody she fights, which is, you know, just one of the reasons to hate these movies. But the major reason to hate these films is because with The Force Awakens, you had essentially a remix of all of A New Hope and some of Empire Strikes Back, where J.J. Abrams, Jar Jar Abrams, as he should be called, who is not an original creative talent at all, he is not an original artist, took the source material and just stitched it into kind of a new Frankenstein's monster. And he threw a lot of special effects at it. I mean, the special effects budgets for these movies were astronomical. But he forgot all of the key elements such as believability, plot, character development, character relatability, character interactions with each other. If you watch The Force Awakens, I mean, it's garbage. The characters are so stupid. They're so unlikable, especially Rey. The only characters who are worth a damn are Han Solo, who looks old and grumpy and unhappy to be around, and Poe Dameron, who gets basically nothing to do during his time in the film. And the plot, such as it is, comes across like it was written by a spastic nerd, a spastic horny nerd on wet Kleenex, used Kleenex, and I'll leave you to figure out what I mean by used Kleenex, because it's that stupid, it's that ridiculous. The plot is just, it's abominably dumb. In no way can you possibly argue that the plot of The Force Awakens made any coherent sense, because it really doesn't. Things show up out of nowhere. Deus ex machina happen just because. Rey is the perfect one at all times. There are so many plot points which are not explained, which make no sense, which have nothing to do with the main story. I mean, you might as well have introduced pod racing into The Force Awakens. And in fact, that's what they did with the next one, The Last Jedi. But at least with The Force Awakens, there were some interesting ideas that came up, you know. Where is Luke Skywalker? Who are Rey's parents? Where did the First Order come from? All this stuff that was interesting and could be followed up on, you know, how did Kylo Ren fall to the dark side? And so on and so forth. All of these things could have been built upon. But then Rian Johnson came in with Kathleen Kennedy's explicit approval, and he took the outline that Jar Jar Abrams had created for the second in this new trilogy, and he basically tossed it straight into a wood chipper, into a paper shredder. And he rewrote it from the ground up. And the entire script for The Last Jedi was designed specifically to be a massive fuck you to fans. It was specifically designed to insult their intelligence and insult them personally. Here's why. In every aspect, The Force Awakens The Last Jedi is subversive, and that's exactly the word that is used by everybody who describes it. It's a subversive script. Jar Jar Abrams called it subversive in follow-up interviews. What he said was, what I liked about the script for the Last Jedi was that it was so subversive. It completely turned everybody's expectations on their heads. You can tell, by the way, that J.J. Abrams really hates what Rian Johnson did to the series, because now J.J. Abrams has to clean up the mess. And that's exactly what he's stuck doing in this new movie. So J.J. Abrams created this outline, Rian Johnson threw it away, and created a movie where really nothing matters. Literally everything about the past of Star Wars has to die, has to be destroyed. So Luke Skywalker, as Bill Whittle in his video points out, Luke Skywalker has to be destroyed. So instead of being this happy, confident, mature man who saves the universe, who saves the galaxy rather, and who brings order and balance out of chaos, he becomes this grumpy, mopey, unhappy, weak, wizened, pathetic old caricature of what he used to be. Han Solo is killed off, you know, and I'm pretty sure that was done with Harrison Ford's tacit approval, because as far as I know, Harrison Ford has always hated the character of Han Solo. Princess Leia, who is now suddenly a kick-ass general, develops force powers for, like, no apparent reason, despite not having any training in any of the previous films or in any of the established canonical work that was created after The Force Awakens was released, because obviously, you know, all of the extended universe stuff was thrown out, and a new canon was established. So all of the expanded universe stuff is now considered what is called Legends. So now Leia is the greatest Force user in the galaxy. None of the characters have anything approaching a decent story arc, because that would be good, right? That would be what the fans want. But no, you can't give the fans what they want. Instead, you have to what the people in charge of these films wanted to do was core out the soul of these films, strip it out, and replace it with something artificial that they had created. Except the problem is, SJWs can't create anything. They're absolutely hopeless at creating something new. So what they had to do was instead warp and twist and subvert what already existed, and then fill the void left behind by their operations with this twisted creation, or this twisted pastiche, this twisted mockery that they had engineered. And The Last Jedi unfortunately succeeded in doing exactly that. I mean, it just destroyed the Star Wars franchise for good. And fans reacted against it extremely viciously. The Last Jedi, I think, underperformed its predecessor by about $800 million worldwide. Now, you have to understand, this was intentional. Disney, the Devil Mouse, made it absolutely clear by putting Kathleen Kennedy in charge with all of her forces female bullshit, all of her diversity uber alles nonsense, all of her, we don't really have any new source material to work from. We don't have a pre-existing base of novels or graphic novels or comics or other media to work from to create this new trilogy that we want. All of this nonsense, she was put in charge for a very good reason. She was put in charge to destroy Star Wars. They're never going to admit that publicly. They're never going to say it. But that's what she was there to do. She was never there to extend the franchise and really make a profitable counterbalance to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. She was there to milk Star Wars dry. That was the reason she was brought in. And she was a fairly senior person in George Lucas's organization for a long time. But Bob Iger and the Disney team put her there to suck the soul out of Star Wars. That was the point. And they have succeeded brilliantly. So now we come finally to The Rise of Skywalker. And if you haven't seen it already, then don't bother, because it's not worth it. I haven't seen it. I'm not going to go watch it. You can find plenty of plot breakdowns and spoilers online. Suffice to say that the worst of our fears have all been realized. This is a visually spectacular film, of course, but it is monumentally stupid in almost every other way. It breaks everything about pre-existing canon. It destroys everything about what we enjoyed about the previous films. There is no redemption. There is no final climactic battle, not really, between good and evil. But the absolute worst thing about this movie, by a mile, is the fact that it is now established in canon that Rey is Emperor Palpatine's granddaughter. She is Emperor Palpatine's granddaughter. Now, leave aside the colossal plot holes involved to make this happen, because remember, in Return of the Jedi, Emperor Palpatine was thrown down the observation tower shaft by Darth Vader after electrocuting Darth Vader with his Force Lightning and pouring on the Force Lightning so badly that he was so consumed with hatred for Luke Skywalker, he was going to kill him. Vader comes up behind him, grabs him, hoists him over his head, and Palpatine is taken completely by surprise and loses control of his Force Lightning. So he's electrocuting himself, he's electrocuting Darth Vader, and he's electrocuting the ground plating of the observation tower that he's on. Vader takes him, throws him down this kilometers-long shaft, because they're standing in an observation deck. Now, it is implied that Palpatine smashes into either the reactor of the Death Star, which I find extremely unlikely, because the canon establishes that the observation tower was, I think, a couple of kilometers above the main hull of the second Death Star, and the second Death Star's diameter was something, the diameter of the second Death Star was something like 160 kilometers. So, you know, in the amount of time that he takes to fall, he's not going to fall into the reactor, which is, what, 80-something kilometers below him. That's not going to happen. It would take him at least an hour, or, well, maybe less, you know, half an hour to fall that far. And it takes him, what, 10, 15 seconds? Maybe that much. Maybe not even that much. So he smashes into something, right? He smashes into probably the floor of where, you know, the turbo lift shaft meets the deck. Okay, fine. You know, he basically falls to the bottom of a lift well, and when he gets there, all of the pent up dark side energy explodes, and there's this cataclysmic release of terrifying energy, showing that the literal embodiment of evil in the galaxy has been destroyed, physically destroyed. Okay, now keep that in mind. The physical embodiment of evil has been destroyed. It was destroyed by the man, Anakin Skywalker, who became Darth Vader, who was intended to bring balance to the Force. And the reason he did it was out of love for his son, who redeemed his father, and in so doing fulfilled the prophecy of the Chosen One and created a wonderful new future for the galaxy ahead. Now, we fast forward like 40-odd years, and we realize that all of that was for nothing. Palpatine survived. How?
I don't know. Who knows?
Palpatine survived being thrown down, you know, a couple of kilometers of turbo lift shaft. And by the way, the Death Star itself exploded because, Lando Calrissian in the Millennium Falcon and Wedge Antilles in his X-Wing flew in, destroyed the power regulator on the North Tower, and then collapsed the reactor itself, flew back out, and the second Death Star exploded. It blew up. Nothing survived. the cream of the entire imperial administration and warrior class was wiped out in that battle. How exactly did the emperor survive? That's not explained. Nobody knows. But anyway, leaving that aside, the emperor survives somehow. And somewhere along the line, he fathered a son or a daughter, whatever. Fine. And somewhere along the line, his offspring, his progeny, sired Rey. Okay, fine. I mean, it's still ridiculous, but okay, fine. At the end of the film, at the end of The Rise of Skywalker, Rey takes her own lightsaber, which is, you know, of her own construction. And somebody passing by asks her who she is, apparently. And she says, Rey. My name is Rey Skywalker. Okay. Stop and think about that for a minute. The lineal, literal, the lineal descendant of good, the man who became good, redeemed himself, brought balance to the Force. Anakin Skywalker, then Luke Skywalker. Anakin is dead. He redeemed himself to bring balance to the Force. Luke is dead through some really ridiculous bullshit in The Last Jedi. Rey is not a blood relation of these men. She is not a blood relation of Leia Organa. She is not in any way linked to the Skywalker legacy. Rey is the lineal blood descendant of literal evil in the galaxy. She is the spawn, whether you like it or not, the spawn of Satan. Think about what the Devil Mouse has done here through Jar Jar Abrams and his writing team. The spawn of Satan is now masquerading as the Messiah's offspring. Think about what that means. And now you will understand exactly why it is that people like us should hate Star Wars so much. This is pure satanic subversive inversion. This is taking all that is good and beautiful and true and turning it on its head in service and worship of evil. And I know I sound rather messianic when I'm saying that. I know I sound like a fire and brimstone preacher. But this is what you have to understand. This is a subversive expectation that is imprinted upon you in a very subtle way. Or actually, maybe it's not that subtle, because, you know, obviously a lot of people are figuring this out, and they're like, what is wrong with you people? This is disastrous, because it means that everything that was done in the Star Wars saga from episodes 1 through to 6 is meaningless. Everything that happened, all of the drama and turmoil and hardship and suffering and pain and loss and redemption is meaningless. All that matters is that a woman is now heir to the Skywalker legacy. A woman who is made up of the same darkness, the same link to evil,
excuse me,
as her grandfather, Sheev Palpatine. Now remember that Sheev Palpatine wasn't born evil. He chose to become evil, and in the process became the greatest instrument for evil the galaxy has ever seen. He became, you know, the greatest and most terrifying Sith Lord of all time. One of the most skilled lightsaber combatants in the entire history of the galaxy. He became the most powerful living expression of dark side energy ever seen. Luke Skywalker, the direct lineal descendant of a man heavily implied to have been created by the Force, or at least, you know, manipulated into existence by Darth Plagueis the Wise, who was Darth Sidious's master, and so on and so forth, and all this other crap that is... I mean, it's ridiculous how much of this canon and trivia is still rattling around in my head. This is the guy... Luke Skywalker is phenomenally powerful in the Force himself. And yet, somehow, despite his tremendous Force power, despite coming through the most terrible of tests. And despite doing exactly what he needed to do to redeem his father and thereby bring balance back to the Force, somehow he's no longer good enough. He has to be replaced. And he has to be replaced by a woman who is, again, this can't be stressed often enough, the lineal descendant of literal evil. If that doesn't tell you how messed up this entire film is, how messed up this entire trilogy is, nothing will. It's literally like saying the granddaughter of Satan comes along and says to the world, "I am the Messiah. Bow down and follow me." If you did that as a Christian, you would be worshipping evil. And that's what this film wants you to do. It wants you to worship and praise and follow evil. And that's why this needs to be fought with every ounce of strength that we have. Now, in the minutes that I have left, I'll address one very obvious question, which is, why are you concerning yourself with something designed for kids? Because that's what Star Wars is. It's designed for kids. The answer is very simple. It is designed for kids. It is designed to brainwash the next generation of children. They're going to grow up watching this movie and thinking that this is normal, that it's okay to have this kind of satanic inversion pulled upon them. They're going to grow up believing that women can be just as strong and competent and, you know, in every way better than men, because that apparently happens in the film too. I mean, Luke and Leia are sparring, and Leia, of course, beats Luke because, of course, she's a woman, because, of course, vagina. And that's the reason why she wins. No, that's stupid. It's just ridiculous in every way to make this presumption. That's not how it works. That's not how the Force works, as grumpy old man Han Solo said in The Force Awakens. The problem is that because our culture has become so detached from everything that it needs in order to function, in particular, a connection with God in the form of Christianity in particular, specifically Christianity, the void of attachment to the numinous, the connection to our spiritual side, is filled through cheap, trashy stuff like Star Wars, which gives us that connection, it fills that spiritual void. Well, what does it say when that spiritual void is filled by something that literally preaches devilry and devil worship and literally inverts everything that is good, beautiful, and true? That's what you get with this movie. That's what you get with the last three films of the Star Wars saga. Now, as far as I'm concerned, these films, I don't even consider them canonical. If I'm going to watch Star Wars, I would watch, I would sleep through much of The Phantom Menace, or as I call it, The Phantom Headcase. I would watch through Fingers, most of Attack of the Clones, or as my sister and I called it, Attack of the Groans, because then an awful lot of that happens, especially in the just appalling scenes where Hayden Christensen is on the screen. I mean, you know, you could have thrown a block of wood on the screen, and it would have done a better job of acting than he did. And, of course, I would watch Revenge of the Sith, quite happily, actually, because Revenge of the Sith, I mean, despite Hayden Christensen's acting, is actually not a bad movie. There are lots of bits of it that are terrible, but overall, it finally closes the loop, or it provides closure for a lot of these questions which have been very long-standing. I mean, it shreds parts of the canon as well, because, you know, obviously Padme Amidala Skywalker dies during childbirth, which directly flies in the face of what is established in Episode 6, which is that Leia knew her mother, and she remembers that she was very sad. she died, her mother died when she was very young, and so on and so forth. So that bit of canon is violated. Okay, fine. I mean, I can live with that. But you can see and you can understand how Darth Vader became who he became, how he became such a terrifying villain, and how great his fall from grace was, and how important it was for him to come back and redeem himself for what he had done, you know, for killing children, for turning his back on everything he believed, for slaughtering the innocent, for killing his wife, essentially. All of this stuff was interesting. I mean, it was a reasonably well constructed plot. It was relatively easy to follow, and it was still recognizably Star Wars in its soul. The soul of the franchise was still there. With this new trilogy, that soul is gone, and we know why. I mean, I've explained exactly why. It had to be killed off. It had to be cored out. It had to be ripped out of the existing franchise, and you know, like those ancient Aztec priests would basically take a sacrificial victim, you know, stab him through the ribs with an obsidian knife, cut open the ribs themselves, crack them open, and then pull out the still beating heart and sort of let it pump out its last few drops of blood into the sky to appease the sun gods and such, you know. That's the kind of sacrifice that was performed on Star Wars. That's basically what the Devil Mouse did. So, if I watch the series at all, I'll watch it like that. I'll watch A New Hope, or Star Wars, you know, A New Hope, with a lot of pleasure, because it's a lot of fun to watch. It's a great movie. I'll watch Empire Strikes Back with great pleasure, because it's such a phenomenally imaginative and interesting and well-paced, well-plotted, really well done film. I mean, in every way, it's such a brilliant movie. It's not Citizen Kane, obviously, but it's still pretty bloody good. Return of the Jedi is a lot of fun. It's a great film, but the Ewoks, I mean, I just, no. The Ewoks is where it all goes a bit wrong for me. And George Lucas is on the record as saying that the Ewoks represented the people of Vietnam, you know, the Viet Cong, and the Stormtroopers represented the terrible, evil, no good, very bad, awful, horrible, disgusting, dreadful American military, which, you know, was a complete betrayal of everything that Star Wars actually stood for. I mean, if you actually look at it, Star Wars, the original film, is a very right-wing movie. So, if I watch it at all, that's how I'll watch it. And I'll try to keep in mind the good memories, the good times, some of the lessons that I've learned from this series. But I won't take it seriously anymore. I mean, I haven't taken it seriously for many years. I abandoned Star Wars a long time ago. I don't feel as though my childhood has been destroyed or anything. I just think, you know, it's very sad to see such a cultural icon, such a cultural touchstone, destroyed in such a way. It's like, in some ways, watching an ancient cathedral with beautiful sculptures and beautiful murals set on fire for no other reason other than that it offends modern sensibilities, which are disgusting and degraded by comparison. So, that's my take on The Rise of Skywalker. Don't go to watch this movie. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your money. I am the Didact. This is the Didactic Mind podcast. As always, feel free to like, comment, share, and subscribe. If you have not subscribed already, please make sure you do. And I will see you on, I believe, Christmas Day, because Christmas is my absolute favorite time of the year, my single favorite day. And I hope to record some thoughts about the day on the day. And we'll see you then. Take care, and I will see you on the next one.